When a 911 dispatcher answers the phone, they have to be ready for anything.
Being a 911 dispatcher is an extremely difficult job. You really do not know what that next call for service is going to be.
More Illinois agencies are training dispatchers to respond to an increase in mental health crises. Also, what are businesses in Carbondale doing to gear up for Eclipse 2017?
We tried to tell them that to plan for the busiest weekend that they've had in their memory.
And comedian Jerry McClellan on making a career in the space where politics and comedy collide.
No one is like, I really agree with you, but just stick to being funny. But how I am funny is pointing out the absurdities in politics and, you know, these big hot button issues.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. When someone's dealing with a mental health crisis, often the first call for help goes to 911 and to a police dispatcher. Last month, all police dispatchers in Chicago's 911 Operations Center got extra training on how to recognize and respond to mental health crises, among other things. For Chicago, the move came after a scathing Justice Department report, but the problem and search for solutions is nationwide. To talk about the role of police dispatchers in mental health awareness and how that's changed in Illinois, we have David Tuttle on the line. He's the manager of the Emergency Communication Center for the City of Peoria. David, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So looking at just some of the numbers that are out there so people can kind of get a sense of what this looks like, about 1 in 10 police calls involve mental health situations. That's according to an article I saw in Governing Magazine. In Peoria, what's the role of the dispatcher when one of those calls come in?
The role of the 911 dispatcher is to obviously listen to the caller, try and understand exactly what kind of need they may have of services, and then to send out the appropriate responder while continuing to listen to the caller and try and keep the caller calm while getting information for the responders as they travel to the scene.
And I mean, I imagine, you know, the only way to do that is to, I mean, you have to very quickly kind of build trust, I guess, to keep them talking, to be comfortable to tell you what's happening.
Yes. I mean, you don't necessarily want to pry, deep into what the situation may be, but you want to get the caller's first name and attempt to develop a quick rapport with the caller while at the same time getting the responders to the location so that they can actually, speak to them firsthand. In Peoria, we have a service called the Emergency Response Service, which is basically a mobile counselor that has that is dispatched through the 911 center here in Peoria, and we actually send those folks with the police or the emergency medical services folks directly to the person's home.
Oh, so there are additional resources. Let's talk about that in a minute. I'm curious to know more about it. You know, coming back to the moment on the phone when you're talking to somebody in a very short amount of time, you have to kind of figure out what the need is there and then make sure the right services go out. You know, when it comes to figuring that out, when it comes to identifying when a caller might need mental health assistance, what does that process look like? How do you get to that point?
Well, it could be very high risk. If the caller is calling and they've already made a determination in their own mind that they're going to, let's say, take their life and they may have a gun or a knife in their hands, then it's very important that the dispatcher work as quickly as possible to try and develop some sort of rapport with the person while sending out the responders to try and get there in time before the person would actually make that decision. It's unfortunately not unusual for the dispatcher to actually, be a part of that scene when the person actually, you know, does something like that. So it really kind of varies. If it's something that's immediately possibly going to happen, then that's much different than if somebody calls and states that they're going to or they're considering taking pills or they may have taken pills or something like that. It's while still very important, it's not, you know, something immediate like someone having a gun or a knife or something like that.
You mentioned earlier that there was a mental health professional who was available and could be called in certain situations. So it's not just police handling everything on their own. How has that relationship developed, and what is it? How does it work now?
Well, I've been the manager of Peoria's Emergency Communication Center since 1995, and when I started here in 1983, we had the service. So the service has been in place for over 35 years, and basically it's called the Emergency Response Service. And it was created by one of our police superintendents many years ago to try and bridge the gap and to provide assistance to police, fire, and emergency medical services to have a trained mental health professional actually meet with the person literally in their home with the officer there, or the emergency response service worker also does respond to the emergency room or to other locations to assist folks. So it's a fairly unique situation that is available in Peoria, and it is one that is its need is great. They're a very busy service, and I'm not sure that we would be able to do without their services.
Have you seen, just curious, with some of the issues around the state budget, and we've heard a lot about some crisis centers and other places closing who provide a lot of mental health services, have you seen an uptick in calls involving mental health crises?
Yes, we've seen, we used to have a mental health facility here in Peoria called Zeller Mental Health Center, and it was a large facility that treated both adults and adolescents. And since that facility has been closed for over 10 years, it actually, our calls for service in this particular area, and police and emergency response service workers, are dealing with a lot more folks that potentially would have been, residents of that center or something like that, and may have even been, inpatient or outpatient treatment.
Yeah, and found care in other ways. Well, I mean, that kind of leads to a question. For someone who does find themselves in the position of having to dial 911 because, someone around them or themselves is having a mental health crisis, do you have any advice? What should people know when they have to pick up that phone?
When they pick up the phone and call 911, I mean, obviously what we need first is the address, and then again, what type of information. But many times that's the last resort for the caller, or what they believe is the last resort. So they're really reaching out. It's a cry for help. So the dispatcher really is the person on the line that can really make or break the that particular situation. So the dispatchers are trained to listen to what the caller has to say, to emphasize, provide empathy with the caller, and to really, have that caring and compassion to the caller as much as possible till the responders actually get on the scene. Being a 911 dispatcher is an extremely difficult job. You really do not know what that next call for service is going to be.
David Tuttle is the manager of the Emergency Communications Center for the City of Peoria. David, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We mentioned earlier that the City of Chicago recently completed training all of its dispatchers in, among other things, recognizing and responding to mental health calls. Let's bring into this conversation now Dr. Julie Morita. She's the Public Health Commissioner for the City of Chicago. And Dr. Morita, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you just heard there, David Tuttle, he's in Peoria, talk a little bit about some of the things that they're doing in that city. How there's what he called a sort of a mobile counselor unit that collaborates with law enforcement. As the public health commissioner in Chicago, what kinds of ways are you seeing public health collaborate with police and emergency dispatchers on mental health issues?
So just to give a little background, the Department of Public Health and the mayor last year, about a year ago, launched our Healthy Chicago 2.0 plan, which is a public health plan for the next 4 years. And among the top priorities that were identified in terms of health conditions was behavioral health, because we know nationwide there are problems with the behavioral health system, whether it's mental health or substance use disorder treatment. And so we have prioritized that. And as a result, there's been significant investments in terms of addressing this need. What Mr. Tuttle described in terms of Peoria's focus on and emphasis on 911 dispatchers being appropriately trained. We just completed training of 100% of our 911 call takers and dispatchers so that they have background and information about individuals who might have mental health or substance use disorder, so they're able to make that distinction about what kind of services are needed. Do they need a crisis intervention trained police officer, or do they need a fire department to come out? So it's really a matter of getting the 911 dispatchers, because they play such a critical role in terms of having them understand what kinds of needs are out there and who best to dispatch.
So that training, it sounds like, focused on being able to recognize in those first, you know, early moments, or what questions to ask. Or maybe I should ask the question, what did that training involve? What did they kind of learn how to do?
So the dispatchers were received training to understand mental health conditions and signs and symptoms of those kinds of conditions, and also some de-escalation training. Because as Mr. Tuttle mentioned earlier, you have to actually keep the individuals calm on the phone while the responders are on their way. And so it's not just a matter of understanding and dispatching appropriate, it's also helping to de-escalate situations over the phone. So the 911 dispatchers were trained. And then in addition to that, the city is committed to having 35% of our police officers crisis intervention trained as well, which means that they go through a comprehensive 40-hour training program where they themselves learn how to interact with individuals who might have mental health issues or substance use disorders to help them deal with the acute situation and then get them to the appropriate services that they need.
So with certain calls, the dispatchers might be able to route the call or send the call out to those trained officers to be able to respond, at least in certain situations.
That's right. I mean, I think we are, you know, it's a whole continuum that needs to be addressed. So the public needs to know that there are police officers who are appropriately trained to help individuals with behavioral health disorders, so they can ask for a crisis intervention trained police officer who is specially equipped to make that distinction and get their loved one to appropriate care. And so we're working on a pilot project on the west side of Chicago to educate the public about the availability of these services. Our 911 dispatchers are then trained to dispatch appropriately, and then our police officers are trained to identify individuals that have these problems and also to get them the appropriate services. So we're trying to address all levels of this continuum.
So you've got that continuum, you know, and you mentioned Healthy Chicago 2.0, and it includes some of the efforts you described, but what kind of things can communities do to reach people in crisis before they have to pick up the phone and are at that moment where they have to dial 911?
Well, I think there's because in nationwide and in the state and in the city, there we recognize that there's a need for behavioral health services that is not being met. And so there's been significant investments from the federal government to try to increase services through federally qualified health centers. So health centers are being asked to, or expected to integrate behavioral health services with their primary care services. And on top of that, many of our healthcare systems and hospitals are enhancing their behavioral health systems to make them more strong and more robust. But in the meantime, when people still are calling 911, we are working with our system to make sure that those individuals who are part of that system actually are best equipped. But there are definite efforts to increase the availability of behavioral health services throughout the city.
So trying to do, you know, for years we've heard that law enforcement across the state and even the country has said that too often police and jails kind of take on the role of the crisis counselors. A lot of efforts, it sounds like, they're not just in Chicago but around the state, trying to bridge some of those divides and bring behavioral health and some more professional help into that cycle that you're talking about.
That's right. I mean, our goal really is to keep those people who have behavioral health issues out of the criminal justice and get them connected to care. We just opened, on the far side of Chicago, we opened up a community triage center with Cook County Health and Hospital Systems. And what that is, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week program where people that have crisis can walk in or be brought in by police officers to get the medical care that they need so they don't end up in the criminal justice system.
You know, you heard David there talk about how they're seeing more and more people calling 911, particularly mentioned now with fewer resources available to mental health treatment. Is Chicago seeing a similar increase in those kinds of calls?
Well, what we do know is that because of the training that our 911 dispatchers received, that there was a significant increase in the number of calls that were classified as requiring these kinds of services. And that's a good thing. What it means is that our staff are better able to identify people who have these type of needs and then appropriately dispatch the appropriately trained police officers. So the fact that our dispatchers are trained, the fact that we'll have more police officers that are trained, will assure that those individuals who happen to call 911 for assistance actually end up in care and not in the criminal justice system.
I see. So it could be part that it's being recognized more and maybe part that the need is growing a little bit too, but perhaps.
Yeah, it's hard to distinguish between the two.
Yeah. So either way, we're starting to see at least the reports of people needing some of these services going on. The state budget cuts, at least in Peoria, we're not helping the situation there. How do you think law enforcement, you know, needs to adapt sort of at this moment in time, do you think, you know, if more and more emergency calls are involving some type of mental health crisis?
I mean, I think this training that we offer our police officers is a critical step. It allows the officers to understand and recognize people who are struggling with mental health issues or substance use disorders, and then recognize that they would be better served if they were in an emergency room or if they were in a triage center where they can get connected to ongoing care. If people get connected to the ongoing care, they're less likely to end up in the criminal justice system, and so awareness is really critical. But it's not just the police, really. It's a matter of raising awareness in the public so that mental illness and substance use disorders are destigmatized and people recognize that there are health conditions that need treatment and that it's okay and appropriate to get treatment. So, you know, the law enforcement is just one piece of the puzzle in order for us to really assure that people's behavioral health issues are being addressed. We really have to raise awareness about and destigmatize these disorders and also increase access to the services that are available. And then by making people aware of these kinds of problems in the community, there's a sensitivity and ability to get people connected to care that is available versus ending up by calling a police officer.
Yeah. In your mind, what's next? What are some of the proactive steps that the city wants to take now?
One of the primary goals of Healthy Chicago 2.0 is to make the city of Chicago trauma-informed. We recognize that people are traumatized on a daily basis, and it can be related to violence, but it also can be related to food, lack of housing, and not enough money coming in because of lack of employment, All these traumatic to individuals. And our goal really is to make the city of Chicago trauma-informed, which means raising people's awareness to the fact that people have this trauma in their lives, recognizing when they have a problem, and then helping them to get access to the services that they need. And so this is a goal of ours. We're marching forward with this effort. We've already done some training with Presence Health System, which is a healthcare system in Chicago, to make training available to all our aldermen and to their aldermanic staff in the communities. We're working on training our health department staff and also our library staff, And then we'll head out to different city agencies and different community organizations in the city to help them raise their awareness.
With awareness and some of those
awareness
things. Well, Dr. Morita, I'm sorry to have to jump in here, but we are just out of time. But thank you very much, Dr. Julie Morita, Public Health Commissioner with the City of Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, filling in today for Nyla Boodoo. And we're going to talk next about how one town in southern Illinois is preparing for the largest event in a generation. As a reminder, this summer, we'll see a total solar eclipse, the first time this has happened in nearly four decades, but you'll only see the true full eclipse if you happen to be along a line that cuts right across the country from east to west, including right through southern Illinois. It turns out that Cedar Lake, just south of Carbondale, is one of the best places in the world to see this eclipse. To give you an idea of just how big a deal this is, last year we spoke with Bob Baer, a physicist at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale and the co-chair of the committee organizing events for the upcoming eclipse. Here's how he explained a total solar eclipse.
The moon blocks the entire sun, and you get darkness as opposed to during a partial, you just get a partial blocking of the sun, and most people can't tell that a partial is actually going on. But with totality, you get darkness. You can see the corona of the sun around the moon, up in the sky. It looks like a white halo, just kind of streaks of light going out away from the sun, and you can only see that during a total solar eclipse.
At least 50,000 pairs of eyeballs expected in and around the Carbondale area to see that eclipse this summer, roughly triple the population of Carbondale itself. That's a conservative estimate. So how does a community get ready for something like this? We're joined now by Stephen Mitchell. He's Economic Development Director for the City of Carbondale. And Stephen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
So 50,000 people, that's a low estimate from what I understand. Some are saying that could be up to a quarter of a million, even more in the area. This is an area around Carbondale, includes about 16 different counties.
That's correct.
What kinds of conversations have you all been having there to prepare for that kind of an influx?
It's been a major effort to try to get ready for something like this. You know, there's really no playbook. Eclipse of this magnitude hasn't happened for 99 years, and it was a different world then. And with the communication technology and the roads, people are a lot more mobile. So we think there's a great possibility of having a huge crowd here, especially as we get closer to the event and more awareness takes place, more people become familiar with the event and just the how dramatic it can be.
And places are already selling out. I mean, it's hard, you know, there's packages that are booked up, hotels are booked up. It's almost to the point where it's hard to get a ticket at this point.
That's true. A lot of our hotels are selling out. Some of the regional hotels are selling out. Now, granted, Southern Illinois, you know, it's a relatively rural and somewhat sparsely populated area, there are only about 3,000 hotel rooms in the region, and that includes beds and breakfast and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So lodging is really kind of at a premium for this.
Campgrounds, and I mean, every inch of space, I'm sure, is going to be looked at for a way to accommodate some of these folks.
Absolutely.
What's the mood there? I mean, particularly among business owners, they excited? Are they nervous? A combination?
Well, there's just so much uncertainty. As I said, there's no playbook for this, so you know how you prepare for something that you're not sure just exactly how big or how small it's going to be. We've taken some of our cues from NASA. NASA and Southern Illinois University at Carbondale are partnering on preparing their event, and you heard from Bob Baer earlier. He's helping to lead that effort.
Mm-hmm.
And, they've done an amazing job. They started about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, getting ready for this. So we've learned quite a bit from them. And
that's going to be sort of the official area to try to see, and there's going to be scientific people there, and kind of what's going on with that event there?
Right. Well, this is a great opportunity for the more scientific-minded to actually study the sun and the aurora around the sun, or the corona, I guess I should say, around the sun, and things that I have no knowledge of whatsoever. But to them, it's extraordinarily important. And so you're going to get a large influx of folks who are purely there for the scientific aspect of it. And then there's a whole other set of people from all over the world who come because it's such a...
It's cool. I mean, it's people like me. It's just an amazing site. It's right here in our state. You know, you can travel. It's not that far to go.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a remarkable opportunity.
It's estimated there's, I think, around 34 million people within a six-hour drive of Carbondale. So there's a potential for it to be a huge event.
All right, so just thinking now about sort of what's coming up, your group is hosting some business forums this week geared toward answering questions from business owners. I mean, getting a little specific now, you know, what kind of questions are you hearing right now? What are people thinking about, concerned about, trying to plan for right now?
They're interested in what's going to happen with the streets. Are the streets going to be closed? You know, what kind of crowds do we expect? You know, what can they do? What can't they do by city ordinance? We're planning on having a musical venue. We're planning some vendor fairs and some other entertainment. Our bars and our restaurants are gearing up. We tried to tell them that to plan for the busiest weekend that they've had in their memory.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want them to go overboard in ordering just in case, you know, if it's a cloudy day. That's one of the issues that we have. You know, so much of the uncertainty evolves around the weather. If it's a cloudy day, we won't get the numbers of people that we're hoping to.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a real possibility in mid-August. I mean, that's...
It can be. I mean, typically the odds are in our favor. That time of year is usually sunny and definitely hot, and the heat is a concern. As we plan, we have to look at the entire experience for the visitor. So not only do we have to get our businesses prepared to make sure they have enough stock on hand and they have staff there and that they have their menus kind of pared down, something quick and easy to fix just to help with a quick turnaround, but we also have to make sure the visitor is comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So Cinnamon Wheel Smith with tourism has done an outstanding job of looking at those kinds of things. So, you know, we're looking at things like making sure water is available and parking and shuttle services and misting stations and cooling areas and restrooms. And it's a little bit like planning for a Super Bowl in your community when you've never had one before.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, and the public safety, making sure that there's access for emergency vehicles. August could be very, very hot, too. You get that many people in a single space. Just a lot of these logistics, you know, it's not just sort of how do I fill my vending machines and make sure that people can get to my business and can I put up a tent, but a lot of public safety questions there, too.
Public safety, transportation, if we do get the number of number of people, the size of crowds that we're expecting, travel is going to be an issue. So we really have to try to keep the traffic flowing and make sure people take care of it that way as well.
So for people who are listening to this, you know, across the state, outside of the state, and maybe planning to come or interested in coming to Carbondale or the area there to catch this eclipse, what do you want people to know at this point about the planning and about the preparation?
We're ready. We'll certainly be ready for you. What you'll have when you get here is a fantastic place in the epicenter of eclipse watching to see an event that normally only occurs once a lifetime, if at that. But Carbondale has a special distinction. In 2024, a second total solar eclipse comes through the area and crosses just above Cedar Lake. So this makes a rare event even that much more rare.
Wow, so two almost back-to-back like that. Where are you going to be come August? What are your plans?
I'll be right in the middle of it.
You'll be looking up or looking around you?
Well, I'll be looking up at least for those the few minutes that we'll be in total darkness. But it's for the city government, it's all hands on deck. You know, we're really gearing up to try to provide our residents and our visitors a safe and enjoyable experience here. And so we'll be out there in the middle of it and answering questions and helping out wherever we need to.
All right. And how can people find out more at this point if they are interested in going and sort of what's still available?
The best source of the most updated information is our website. It's carbondaleeclipse.com.
Great. And we'll also make sure that we tweet that out and post that up so people can find that.
Oh, that'd be great, yeah.
Good luck. I mean, this is a massive undertaking. It sounds like you guys are well on your way, and the event is going to be really cool. Sort of a once-in-a-lifetime event here. Stephen Mitchell, Economic Development Director at the City of Carbondale, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Over the past year, we've talked about efforts in several Illinois towns to confront issues related to race and discrimination. Last summer, Jeffrey Perkins told us about some of the ways residents in Decatur are working together, including the Conversation on Race. It's an annual event I've been organizing in Decatur for the past 9 years, one that actually Jeffrey Perkins got started. This year's Conversation on Race is scheduled for next Thursday. And Jeffrey Perkins on the line again from Decatur. He's the founder of Caring Black Men of Decatur, one of the organizations hosting this 9th annual Conversation on Race. And Jeffrey, welcome back to the 21st.
Well, glad to be here.
I'd like to ask you about the theme of this year's conversation here in a moment, but before we talk about kind of that larger context, I'm wondering about this moment. You know, even in the title of the event this year, it says, "Are we in the middle of a moment or a movement today?" You know, this is the first annual conversation on race since the 2016 election. Some of the cultural, social divides that we've seen, you know, come up over the past year. Has that affected your plans for this year?
Well, I guess we feel the need to continue this dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Once what we saw what happened during the election and the divisiveness and the country being kind of split apart, and so it just kind of lets you know that the need is still there, even in 2017. You know, in our city of Decatur, there's been signs for years that when you come in, it says racism not in our town. But more than a sign, I think we need the conversation. We need dialogue because from year to year, it seems like it's always something different. But I think race and race issues are always going to be with us. And so that's why we need conversations, open and honest dialogues on race, because it helps us get a better understanding of one another. And we don't always agree. But again, if it's an ongoing dialogue, I think that's going to be beneficial to our community,
yeah,
and other communities also.
And one of the things that, you know, we've talked with you before on the show, too, is having that kind of an honest conversation. That can be tough during the best of times. You know, can you kind of bring us inside the conversation a little bit, you know, the conversation on race that you have planned? What should people expect? What are the ways that you try to spark, instigate, you know, bring open conversation to the table?
Well, actually, for the first 7 years, we'd have a speaker come in, and then we'd have a panel discussion after the speaker's presentation. And so last year we decided that, at the main event to have just a community discussion. We put out some different questions and scenarios on each table, and that kind of stimulated the conversation. And again, this year we're kind of looking at talking about 50 years after, you know, Civil Rights Act and the Kerner Report, are we better off? What would we be doing for the next 50 years?
Yeah.
And so just, again, just to try to get some sort of understanding of what different people's ideas are when it comes to race, especially in our community. Each community is, you know, different. And so things that are affecting us here in this community, different issues, elections, school board elections, neighborhoods, our youth, different things like that. And so to have, we're going to try to mix the tables up where we have young people and older people together to kind of compare what maybe some of them went through back in 50 years ago in the civil rights movement, and then what young people are going through today. Actually, we're going to have at the beginning two songs. One is called Marvin Gaye's song of What's Going On, which was published in 1971.
Yeah.
And now in John Legend's song of Glory, which is the theme for the Selma movie.
Kind of
bookend. And the lyrics from those two different songs kind of coincide, but they're actually 50 years apart. And so, and able to talk about today and 50 years ago, race relations, where we, again, where we've come, and some ideas of what we can do here in Decatur, and maybe even in our country, yeah, as we move forward and for the next 50 years.
One thing I want to come back to is, you know, the theme this year. You mentioned, you know, kind of 50 years after the Civil Rights Act and the Kerner Report. You know, what could the next 50 years look like? I mean, you know, just a reminder to folks that the Kerner Report, I mean, it was a blunt assessment of racism in the United States during the 1960s, the roles and responsibilities of white people in creating and perpetuating that racism. You know, ultimately it said, you know, the well-known line, the country was headed towards two societies, one white, one black, separate and unequal. A lot more to it, and we can, you know, we can share the link and people can go and read it for themselves. But why did you choose the report as one bookend of this look back and look ahead right now at this moment?
Well, at that point, I think it just took a snapshot of where we actually were, you know, at that point in time. And here we are 50 years later, and you see a lot of similarities in where I think John F. Kennedy had an address to Congress, I think it was 62, and he talked about the mortality rates of young African-American males, the opportunity of being unemployed or not graduating college, and being promotions and jobs. And if you look at that, if you look at the numbers, some of the numbers are still 50 years later. We've made a lot of strides, great strides, but then in a lot of ways, some of the things are still not, you know, where they should be. And here we're talking 50 years later. And so with our young people coming together and being involved, hopefully, we're talking about where are we going to be 50 years from now,
yeah,
that we won't be around, but they will. So what needs to be done and what should be done to try to, you know, alleviate or try to improve the situation of those issues in our country?
You mentioned the involvement of, you know, the students, of younger people in the community there. What are you looking to the younger folks to bring, especially in these conversations with some of the adults who may, you know, have ideas that are a little more set in, maybe?
Well, you know, a lot of our young people are not even familiar with some of the civil rights issues that existed 50 years ago. And then some of our older people today aren't really in touch or in tone with what our young people are going through when it comes to racial issues. So it's just a way of, you know, bringing people together, and in some ways you see there's not a lot of difference in some things that are still happening. But we do know that our young people 50 years from now, I'm probably not going to be here, and so it's going to take our young people to, you know, pick up the baton and carry on with you know, try to make our communities better. And they just need to understand that these are going to be the things that's going to help them, empower them to have a voice, and, you know, in their communities and in their nation, that to come out and be able to maybe listen to some of the people who were there 50 years ago to talk about the importance of what it was, you know, when people died and fought to have these rights, and then now some that may be taken for granted because they just don't feel like, you know, my vote doesn't matter, or you know, those type of things.
Yeah. Well, another important moment here, and this year's Conversation on Race, scheduled for next Thursday, was created and launched 9 years ago by Jeffrey Perkins, continues on with a number of organizations that he mentioned there. Jeffrey Perkins, founder of Caring Black Men of Decatur. Jeffrey, I appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
It's the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, this is an interesting moment for a lot of reasons, but especially to be a comedian, and especially a comedian who likes a good political joke. Saturday Night Live has rebounded into cultural relevance. John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah, they're all kind of taking on big cultural and political issues at this moment. Comedy and politics, obviously, have long been tied together. In some cases, seem almost inseparable. As one recent example here, Jeremy McClellan, he's a comedian based in Charleston, South Carolina, won the Charleston stand-up comedy competition 2 years running in 2015 and 2016. He's now out there doing comedy full-time, be performing in Champaign-Urbana this coming weekend. Jeremy, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So it's tough to label performers, maybe especially so in your case, you know, so...
Sure.
You're a white Christian guy from the South, a large following of young Muslims in North America. You focus a lot of your comedy on politics, on political issues. How do you describe the comedy you do?
Well, I mean, I think comedy in general is just all about the ridiculousness of human attempts to, like, control reality and to understand reality. And so anytime there's a mismatch between the two, it's funny. Like, I mean, even just, you know, basic jokes about, like, puns, it's just like, okay, so our language is an attempt to, you know, to describe reality, but language can mean a bunch of things. So, like, that's inherently funny. And so politics is definitely a huge, and culture and society and all these, you know, big issues, those are all inherently ridiculous because people, you know, you're not able, you know, politicians, you're not actually able to get what you want done, because you're trying to control so many people and you're trying to control so many different things. Especially, I think, if you're Donald Trump and your entire idea is to make America great again and to make America be a certain way, despite actual Americans, you know, not following along.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've been doing this now. I think you said your first stand-up gig was about 4 years ago.
Right.
How has your comedy and the jokes you tell and the reaction to it changed since what we saw, you know, throughout 2016 and then after the election too?
Right. You know, I've always been doing the same types of comedy about politics, about politicians, about foreign policy and immigration and civil liberties and those types of issues. You know, religion has always been something that's really important to me and also something that I like to joke about. And so I've been doing that for, you know, ever since I started. What has happened is that in the last year and a half, people have become very, very thirsty for that kind of comedy. And I mean, especially, you know, as it relates to Trump, I was saying the exact same things about Obama, you know, when he was running, but people didn't necessarily want to hear that as much. So I don't think that my material has changed an awful lot. But, you know, as much as I've grown in the last year, and, you know, been able to do this full time and to get so many gigs. I think that is an expression of people's desire to have comedians point out the absurdity of politics, because, you know, comedians are not experts in, you know, public policy or economics or whatever. We're not actually experts, but we are experts in the absurdity of those endeavors. And of politics in general. And so I think people feel like we are in a very, very absurd point in time when, you know, there's so many ham-fisted government ways, and just, you know, society in general is getting very, you know, it feels like it's getting more ridiculous.
So it's sort of comedy as cultural anthropology, you know, sort of dissecting the moment and kind of seeing where, I mean, you touch on some of these issues. You mentioned, you know, comedians, I mean, like many, I'm certainly not an expert in public policy and things like that, but there are people out there who are saying, what do you make of this? Who might argue that, you know, hey, a comedian, just be funny, just make us laugh, you know, quit talking about politics.
Yeah, but laughter is, right. I mean, people say that, and usually it's because they disagree with your politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no one is like, I really agree with you, but just stick to being funny. And it's like, okay, but how I am funny is pointing out the absurdities in politics and, you know, these big hot button issues. So, you know, and it's true that when people go and, you know, some people, when they go and see a comedy show, they just want to hear jokes about hats or something like that, you know, you know, silly stuff, but, you know, even jokes about hats, like, even that is going to be about the absurdities of us trying to understand the world and us trying to make sense of it. Which is, you know, there's always going to be a tension in how we try to control the world. And so I think that, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, well, and comedy has long filled that kind of space, that tension, mm-hmm. and pointing out that absurdity.
Yeah, I mean, when has comedy ever not been political? I don't know what this, you know, even just going back to like the earliest, it's like, well, it's court jesters, like mm-hmm. next to the king. So I don't understand why, but people, I guess, if you make a joke and they feel like it's at their expense, they feel like you're making fun of their favorite politician, they will get mad and be like, just stick to comedy. And you're like, I am. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, see, it feels like you walk a lot of lines, right, as a comedian, mm-hmm. especially as, you know, who you are, doing jokes about politics, about race, about Muslims, about Islamophobia. I mean, how mm-hmm. do you navigate? Do you feel like you're constantly navigating these lines between being funny and something else?
Yeah, but I think, I mean, again, I think that being funny is inherently subversive of those kind of constructs. And so, you know, it's not as if, like, I'm being funny about something and then I'm like, but seriously, everyone. And then I give a speech about, how we should all come together or something like that. So for me, there's not a big line between comedy and all the serious stuff that I do. Mm-hmm. It's all just pointing out the ridiculousness of those attempts. It is tricky trying to find a line between, you know, how to navigate all those subjects in a way that people like. I mean, that's always tricky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's play one. We've talked a lot about your comedy, and there's nothing worse than saying, hey, be funny in the moment here. But we do have mm-hmm. a clip here that we pulled off of, I think it was off of your Facebook page. Let's just hear a moment here from one of your recent performances.
The other day we got into an argument because she was saying that women still make 77 cents for every dollar that a man makes, right? But like I explained to her, that's just because men naturally gravitate towards higher paying professions, like doctor or engineer or CEO, whereas women, this is true, just naturally gravitate towards lower paying professions, like female doctor and female engineer and female CEO. It's not our fault you don't apply for the regular jobs. Turn the application over. It's all right there. The fine print. I think men should make more than women. I do. You know why? Because we provide for women, right? We end up... Hold on. We end up sharing all that extra money with our wives and our daughters to take care of them, which can get really expensive because I don't know if you guys know this, but they only make like 77 cents for every dollar that a man makes. So like, if anything, we should be getting a raise just to make up for all the sexism women experience in the workplace.
I wasn't quite sure there at first where you were going with that. So there, you know, we talked about kind of that tension and the absurdity.
Well, yeah,
it's a little uncomfortable, right, in that moment. I mean, is that kind of representative of your approach there?
That's the point. So a lot of times people come up to me after the show and they like, you know, like, or they hear that joke and they want to know, what do you think about the wage gap, right? They want to mm-hmm. know, what's your opinion on, like, do women really make less or is it the actual same jobs? And that completely misses the point of it, because like what they're trying to do is they're trying to translate a joke into prose and then judge that like into like, you know, some opinion, like, you know, a sort of like reverse engineer the joke into a statement. And then do they agree or disagree with that statement, when really the point of that joke is to make women in the audience mad and then happy and then mad and then happy and then mad and then happy. And that's fun. You know, sort of knock you off your feet and, you know, sort of use bad logic and kind of like that to me is that's inherently funny.
And playing off of who you are, too. I mean, that joke would be very different coming from a woman. But you are here. You are a guy and a white guy standing on stage making that joke. And there's a whole different tension there.
Right. But it's about the effect that you have on the audience. And so what I think. And I do that with like any subject. So like any subject that comes up, you know, I find the absurdity. I find some like weird logic. I can apply to it, and that's funny. So it's not necessarily like, okay, I want my audience to think a certain thing about the wage gap. So how do I tell a joke that makes them think that? Like, I think that's sort of using comedy as propaganda, and I don't think that's necessarily a good thing.
I mean, obviously the point of comedy is to make people laugh. I can see that. We heard that there, and I mean, I felt that there and that during that joke. You know, looking sort of at the way you're using social media now, the commentary, sort of the cultural mm-hmm. critique that we see right now that you're working on as well, not when you're not on stage even, you know, it seems like that you're, mm-hmm. How has that evolved for you? Are you trying to do more now than make people laugh? Are you trying to spark more of a kind? Is there something bigger that you're trying to do right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I do have opinions about American foreign policy and immigration and things like that. And I do think these are questions that need to be addressed. And for me, it's like, okay, well, what's my role? So like, I'm not an expert on immigration. I don't work for a think tank. But I do find these types of issues ridiculous, and you're sort of our attempts to make reality the way that we want it to make America the way we want it to, sort of like, you know, it's a very conceited way of trying to organize society. And so I do want to draw attention to those things. I do have opinions, and if it's on social media, I'll put my opinion out there. That's fine. When I'm on stage, it's just jokes. So there is sort of a difference between coming and seeing a show, where like hopefully everything I say is funny, versus like just my opinions on social media. But I definitely have opinions that I'm not afraid to share.
So this coming weekend you'll be in Illinois. You're part of the Muslim Students Association Spring Conference here at the mm-hmm. University of Illinois. That's a common type of a venue for you across the country. You know, you have thousands of fans,
right.
And tens of thousands of fans on social media. Many of them mm-hmm. are Muslim across North America. Both, mm-hmm. you know, did you set out specifically to reach a Muslim audience, or how did that grow?
No. Well, I mean, I was saying all the things that I normally say, and that I have been saying for years. And then about a year and a half ago, all the stuff that I was saying just started sort of going viral within the Muslim community. And I had some high-profile people, like this guy Yasir Qadhi, who shared my page and told people to like it. And so that's, you know, things like that. And then I got booked for some events that were Muslim, and they went well, and word travels fast within the Muslim community. And so it just sort of organically grew from there. But the things that I'm saying now are the same things that I was saying 2 years ago when I had Muslim friends. But I didn't have, you know, like a ton of Muslim fans.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about sort of your trajectory, and, you know, you won the competition in Charleston there 2 years
sure.
in a row, and I'm growing, and now you're touring nationally and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the logical progression for comedians and entertainers and performers in general is kind of you keep going to bigger and bigger stages. Is that something you're looking for? What's the space that you ultimately want to be in, do you know?
You know, there's no I think there used to be a logical progression among comics where and there still is to an extent. So like you perform at bigger venues and then like, you know, you go on Conan, and you know, there's this very logical progression. You release albums, and there's this, you know, I think and that was the way that you made it as a stand-up comedian.
Or you go on public
now,
radio, and hey, you know, that's
yeah, absolutely. This is my big shot. So that was the normal progression. Now you can do it however you want. So like, I skipped a lot of stuff by, you know, getting big on social media. Like Bo Burnham went from YouTube videos to like a Comedy Central special like really fast because he was huge on YouTube. And so I think social media and all these other, you know, other ways of connecting directly with fans, because like, I don't even know how they used to do it in the old day, where they like toured and then they were like, okay, well, like, you know, just I may be here in a month, and like, so yeah, I may come back to this, you know, this city, so come and see me then. Like, you know, join
sell
my
some
mailing
CDs
list. Like,
and join a mailing
that
list.
Would have been yeah that would have been so, you know, I think now is like a really exciting time to be a comic, where you can reach people directly and you don't have to go through all these other mediating institutions. But you know, I'm yeah, obviously, you know, bigger and better things. But a year ago, I wouldn't have planned this past year. I wouldn't have been able to plan it. So I'm just sort of going with the flow and riding the wave.
Riding the wave. Well, we will tweet out information on, you know, where you're going to be and when and all that good stuff. But Jeremy McClellan, comedian, based there in Charleston, South Carolina, coming to the campus of the University of Illinois this coming weekend. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Great.
I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Well, that'll do it for us here today. You can always find past shows of the 21st on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. Also available on iTunes and Android. Follow us on Twitter. Search for the 21st show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis, background. You can chime in there. Also, of course, on Facebook. Search for the 21st. Like us. Comment on what we're working on. Post questions, comments. We might want to ask us on the air. We're produced by Hala Dalahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Scott Cameron. I've been sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.